Hello, and welcome to the Rooted in Reliability podcast, your plant performance podcast, where we dive deeper into asset management techniques and know-how. I'm your host, James Kovacevic, and I will be your guide to achieving industry best practice. The Rooted in Reliability podcast is here to provide you with the insights to improve plant performance and deliver bottom-line results to your organization. In case you missed the last episode, you can find the Rooted in Reliability podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and on the reliability.fm network. Don't forget to subscribe so you'll never miss an episode. Now let's dive into today's topic. It's my pleasure to welcome back Fred Schenkelberg. Welcome back, Fred.
Yeah, thanks, James. Glad to be back.
It's great to have you back on. And, you know, what I want to talk about today is something that, you know, I've been seeing over and over coming up. And people always talk about the PF curve. And I'm sure you're familiar with the PF curve. And you know, it talks about when you have a potential failure to when it actually fails, you have a functional failure. And some of the PF curves, you know, they're nice and they identify here, this far up is where vibration is, this far up is where you can use ultrasound to detect that potential failure. And it's all talking about being able to catch the failure after it happened, before it becomes a functional failure, right? So when we start to see a defect before we get that functional failure.
Yeah, that doesn't predict the forklift driver ramming through your equipment too well, but it does go after bearing wear out, for example, or misalignment, drift, and all kinds of issues. It does get a good number of things, but it doesn't capture everything.
No, and when I look at it, I start thinking about it, and that's almost reactive. We're reacting to a defect that has already occurred. And we're just catching it before it has an impact on the organization. And I understand one of the key principles behind RCM2 by John Mowbray is to minimize the consequences of the failure. And that's what the goal of a good maintenance reliability program is. But could we be doing anything better further up that curve so we don't even hit that potential failure point? What are we missing there?
Don't buy equipment that fails. you know, Well, you know, my opinion is if you're going to buy equipment, get the stuff that's robust and has got more headroom and capability and capacity and has a good reputation and has all of the things that you, the finance guys and the folks with the budget are going to cringe because it's going to cost more almost always. Yet it'll pay for itself over and over and over again, but it's, get involved with the design. Get involved with the details of, is this a good piece of equipment? Is it thought out? Is it suitable for our environment? One, I think that should be a basic part that anybody does. But is it fit within our larger system? Do we have maintenance technicians that already know how to work on this equipment? Or is it a completely different set? Do we have to buy new tools? Do we have to buy new diagnostic equipment? Do we have to use a special lubricant that's only proprietary to this one? Are we locked into things like that? I worked with one client. They had every known model from all the available vendors for their suite of equipment. They had 168 of these devices, and they had, I think, 38 unique ones. And they were proprietary components and, you know, all kinds of stuff, which even screw sets and threads were unique between the vendors. They were trying to lock you into only buy their parts, but they all did that. And these guys, every time they bid a new piece of equipment out, they took the lowest bidder without consideration of the impact to the maintenance program, which this equipment would last 20, 25 years. And so the cost of maintenance significantly outweighed the purchase price, but it wasn't considered. And so the specifications and the design of what they were trying to buy just wasn't thought out very well. And it was kind of sad. But the more you can get into, it's not just this custom design to get your particular product and your plant put together, but it's also designed for maintenance. How am I going to operate this thing and maintain it and detect failures and to optimize those things? And what's the impact if I don't have access, if it takes me an extra 6 hours to change a motor out versus another vendor that, or a design change that allows me much easier access? And it may take 20 minutes to get it out. So that level of detail that I think we tend to be short-sighted of in some organizations. And obviously, there are some organizations that really do consider that appropriately.
Yeah, and I think I think when we start talking about designs, there's multiple pieces here. Is are we specifying the equipment properly? What's the operating context? What do we demand from this equipment? All that has to be understood. Then, if we're putting this piece of equipment into a process, how does it interact with the other parts of the process?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've seen that where all the equipment works with your existing data flow and data collection and all of the signaling and everything else. All of the throughput and belts all were timed on one system. They brought in a labeler that was unique. and I go all through all these custom software and trait, and it took them months to get it sorted out so it would actually work with the line. You should have thought of this 6 months ago when you were ordering it.
Yeah, it was, absolutely. Come on. And that's the, correct me if I get the term wrong, but that's systems engineering, is how do all these components act together in a wider system,
right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
And that is, to me, that's a huge part of the design process, is that systems engineering, that configuration management, though all that has to be taken into consideration when installing a system or an asset in a particular plant.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I worked with contract manufacturers that were making circuit boards when I was back at Hewlett-Packard. And I was visiting a factory in Mexico, and they were expanding. They were building buildings about as fast as you could, you know, from week to week, they had more floor space. And in the morning, we walked in, and it was a big, empty room. And they told me, we're planning on putting 40 assembly lines on this floor. And they're still laying tile on the floor, this electrostatic tile to control static electricity in the plant. They were still laying it down on the last corner of the building in that morning when we walked through. In the evening, we walked back out. They were finalizing a verification run of a production line, and it had solder paste, it had placement, it had a reflow oven, it had some more placement, it had a wave solder, and it had inspection stations, all in one belt, all in one line. And that equipment was brought in that morning, uncrated, lined up, bolted down, and run by 5 o'clock. And they were planning to start production on the evening shift. And then the next day, they put in 3 more lines, and the next day, 3 more lines. They had it down, but it was all exactly the same equipment. So anything they learned on the first one, they could immediately replicate through all the rest of their installations.
Yeah, but in order to do something like that, that tells me there is tremendous amount of upfront work in the design, the model.
Oh, definitely.
Configuration
oh, yeah.
management, systems engineering. All that was done to a T upfront. They had the specs. They built to the specs. They probably did validations of the lines before they came on site. To me, that sounds like they had this process nailed down.
Oh, they did. It was amazing. And the plant was up and running, you know, in a couple of weeks, putting out millions of circuit boards, and it was clean. It ran smoothly. It was just not a joy.
In my experience, that is not the norm. It can be done.
Yeah, it can be done. But you're right. It does take a lot of upfront work, and right from the design. I mean, simple things like what's the height of our conveyor belt, but it's also belt speeds and how they're going to communicate with each other, and what are we going to inspect and check, and what are the stops, and what if something goes wrong, what are the fallbacks, and what's buffering, and are the technicians and engineers capable and trained to know what they're doing? They're not learning it the first time they see this equipment. They all of that was done prior as they invested in bringing this plant up. But they executed it. This is the part that I saw, was just magical.
Yeah, absolutely. That is magical. I wish I could see that. So when organizations are looking to bring in a new piece of equipment and they want something like that, they want to be able to literally bring it in, install it properly. When I say install it properly, I mean proper anchors, doing the alignments, taking baseline readings for predictive maintenance, doing all those wonderful things. What do they need to do to get through the design process to make that happen? What are the, I don't know, 3 or 5 things that they should do if they expect that kind of result or want that kind of result?
Well, it's one of those where it's rare in my experience that out of the catalog equipment, oh, I need a labeler. Somebody you're buying that equipment from is probably going to ask you a bunch of questions. right from the start. But what communication protocol are you using? What kind of sensors are you going to put on it? What's the environment? What's the humidity, even if you've got adhesive drying? What's the surrounding elements of it? So a good vendor will work with you in order for them to deliver the right equipment to you. If they're not, you need to be asking those questions and getting that stuff right up front. But it starts with, in my mind, is, well, what could go wrong? What are the areas that in that process of setting it up and getting it ready to run and during operation, what could go wrong? Could be alignment, it could be damage, it could be missing parts, it could be we don't understand how to do the diagnostics on it, we need training and experience on it, and so on. So part of that investment is not just, oh, we need that piece of equipment. It's looking through that rest of that program from the operators to the maintenance team, can we take care of it? The other story is you get a piece of equipment and these guys will remain unnamed, where they installed a new piece of equipment and it broke down in the first shift. And they all sort of around looking at it going, well, we don't know how to do anything with this. We've never seen it before. You know, the maintenance team was surprised that, oh, there's a new labeler here. They don't even have the tool set to open it. They don't know where the safety interlocks are. they're blind to it. Now, they're going to try to do their best job. It's going to take a lot longer. And they may or may not be able to get it back up and running. And it's really a waste of resource there. Where if you would have spent 2-3 days and got these guys trained up and familiar with the equipment and gone through the paces of it, it would be a whole lot smoother operation. Still a learning curve, yet you're not starting from scratch. And that's just a little bit of foresight. The design elements, though, the part that I see that's often overlooked is that, will it work in my environment?
So not having a good understanding of the operating context that it'll be used for.
That's right.
For example, is it going to be located at a port getting blasted with salt spray all day?
That's right.
Or is it going to be located inland where there's dry and no humidity?
And a lot of static, right? Yep. Try putting moving paper when it's staticky. You know, it doesn't work. And is it controlled humidity or not? Is it dusty or dirty? I was surprised. I didn't know this about bottling plants. They have these $1 million pieces of equipment, and they take a fire hose, a 2-inch fire hose, and hose it off as their cleaning process. Now, if I was designing a highly complex, you know, thousands and thousands of moving parts in a robot, I would have not expected somebody to take a fire hose and blast away at it. But they do. That's how they clean them.
And that's part of the design spec that needs to be called out. We need to define washdown rated. With a fire hose, maybe you put that in there just so it's clear.
Well, with certain pressure, certain kind of, and they had different solvents they used in it and surfactants so that it would act, it was just soap, essentially. And that could just tear up equipment if they didn't know it was coming at them.
This podcast is brought to you by Iridicio. Be sure to check out iridicio.com for a free copy of their ebook, A Smarter Way of Preventative Maintenance. This ebook will allow you to review your current maintenance program and eliminate the non-value-added work you're doing, which is most likely causing you more downtime than it is preventing. www.iridicio.com.
So being able to clearly define how it's going to operate in our facility, what our demand will be on that asset.
Mm-hmm.
Once we have all that spec'd out, then do we go shopping or is there other things we need to do?
Well, yeah, it's where's your partnership, right? Who can you work with? And I always have a hard time with the procurement groups that want to go to the newest vendor that gave them the best lunch last week. No, we've got a good reputation, a rapport with vendor A, and they may or may not be the lowest price compared to what else is available on this thing. But we have the equipment. We know who to call. We have a track record with them. We know they're a known quantity. We're not taking a risk, not knowing how good their equipment is. We can work with them to get the design. We can work with them to understand the critical parts that we need to stock, the unique maintenance features that we need to be aware of and get up to speed on. That's got a lot of value. And I think we talked about it in our last episode that we talked about is that's kind of a soft value. If I know exactly who to call and who to influence a design so that we have the access panels we need for our plant, it saves me hours every time I have to deal with it. Whereas I save $20 and they don't put an access panel there and we don't get the chance to interact with them to get that design change, I may have to lift the whole device out to get access to it every time. shutting the line down for a whole shift. And that's just short-sighted of how important that communication is and that ability to work with the design team to get it, one, for them to understand your environment, dust and debris and humidity and the weather and cleaning process, all those pieces. But then also from the maintenance point of view, can I even access it from the back of the machine? You know, are we putting it up against the wall? And if you don't tell the designers, they put all the access panels on that side, you know? Yep. And then it's an unpleasant surprise when you get to the factory.
Yeah. So clearly articulating the needs and the wants up front as well with that, in that partnership,
mm-hmm.
helps to refine the design, make sure it will work for your environment, where it's positioned, how it will interact with the other equipment, so on and so forth.
Yeah, the hard part, you know, and you know this, James, is that the functionality, you know, what's the primary purpose of, say, putting a label on or filling a bottle or bending metal or whatever the equipment's primary function is, that gets all the attention. Can we make our product and do it quickly and with high quality? And so the layout, the design, the durability, the maintenance practices, all those things, it's secondary in its primary purpose of the equipment. Yet I think the more enlightened organizations understand the value of getting that right from the start. And so they're at the table. They're a part of that wants and needs list. It's not just throughput. It's minimizing downtime. And it could be diagnostics, it could be access, it could be whatever, but if that's not part of that discussion, I think we really shortchange that entire process and hobble the maintenance team going forward if we don't do that right.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a lot of different pieces here, right? You know, when I think of the design piece, you know, we have the function, we have our needs and wants. Some of those needs and wants come from the maintenance staff through past experience, through understanding what the process is wanting.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of it should be coming from the equipment specifications that the company has. Here's the communications protocol we're going to use. Here's the brand of PLCs we're going to use.
Right.
And
right.
So on and so forth. Having that documented in a clear, easy to understand document that's updated on an ongoing basis, I think,
mm-hmm.
would go a long way as well to further improving the reliability, because now we know what are the known failure modes with this stuff. We may update and start substituting different components for different manufacturers if we know we have an existing issue with a particular manufacturer. So right. When I think of this design, it's all about processes and standards.
Yep.
Am I missing something there, or is that?
No, it's not uncommon to say in a design team to have a design for reliability manual. Here's our guidelines, our standards. You know, if we're going to do an attachment with a bolt, it has to, because of our environment, it has to have a certain torque in certain holding force kinds of things. And it's those little details that it's worth documenting, because you don't need to reinvent that every time. And so it saves the design team from having to second guess or call you back and ask, how are you going to attach this to the floor? Here's the standard. Here's the PLCs we're going to use in communication. Those are decisions that are done. It streamlines the process, and it works in your implant, as opposed to this other group that had 15 different vendors and different protocols for every one of them. It was crazy.
Absolutely. And, you know, once we get that equipment designed properly using all those things we just talked about, now we got to install it correctly.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's a whole another beast of its own.
Yes.
Because once it's designed properly, if you don't install it properly, it's still not going to do what you want it to do.
That's right.
And I think that goes to multiple things. I think that goes back to having the proper procedures and processes in place to make sure that when it does arrive on site, we install it correctly, we commission it. We have those standards again that define how do we anchor stuff. Is it, you know, with chemical anchors? Is it mechanical anchors?
Mm-hmm.
All those different things have to be defined.
And then the alignment. You did a couple of really nice interviews on alignment, and one of the things I remember taking away from that is that, you know, the equipment heats up in different places, and it's going to expand and contract in different ways in different operating modes. And so taking that into consideration in the design so that you maintain the trueness that you need. But then also over time, as you, dead cold equipment can be laser aligned, which is really not how you're using the equipment. So you got to take that into account, is when it's hot, when it's running materials, running product. Yeah, and that's just alignment. There's all those other factors you're talking about, anchoring and access and the power and communication lines in and out of it.
Yeah, do you have the right foundation underneath that piece of equipment? I was doing I was actually doing some research for a paper I'm going to present at SMRP on what I titled the PF Curve Redefined, the Importance of Proper Machinery Installation.
Okay.
And when you're putting in a rotating piece of equipment, you need a base that is, you know, so many times larger than the mass of that piece of equipment.
Yeah, otherwise it's going to walk away with your floor.
Exactly. But if you put in a reciprocating piece of equipment, there's a huge difference in the size of foundation you need. I want to say it goes from 5 times the mass to 10 times the mass if you go reciprocating.
Oh, wow.
This is rotating. Like, it's absolutely massive how that changes.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, there's all these little things that you need to consider when you're designing, because you don't, size of the foundation is defined during the design phase of that asset.
That's right.
You know, so you need to understand that. Where do you put the anchors? How close can you put them together? I did some more research on that, and there's a lot of different things on the overlap and how a lot of anchors are positioned too close together that could cause issues, whether it's the asset breaking loose or extra vibration and all these other things.
Yep.
And unfortunately, in almost every machinery install I've been involved with, there isn't those types of standards for installation. There isn't that rigor put on that installation. And going back to the beginning of the conversation, nobody seems to care about that part of the PF curve before the P.
That's right.
But if we want to deliver the maximum value to an organization, that's where we should be focused.
Well, you and I have had this discussion about root cause analysis. Is everybody understands it's useful, and I don't think anybody's going to deny that getting the equipment designed and installed correctly is useful. But I want it running this afternoon. You know, there's a lot of other constraints, and so it's a cultural thing in an organization that they get the permission, the time, and the skills to do it right. And because there's an understanding that is useful to do and it's valuable to do. It's a long-term investment, though, right? If you get the alignment right, your equipment's going to stay steady and provide good performance for years, where if you get it wrong, it may be good for 2-3 months. And then we're on to the next project. Everybody's focusing somewhere else. And then you have these niggling issues. Things are breaking. Things are coming loose. We're getting more scrap from it. It's got more unscheduled downtime. But it's never really tied all the way back to it was the alignment's gone bad or the alignment was bad from the start. That's really hard to diagnose after the fact.
Absolutely.
And that's just one example. There's plenty of them.
So if you could share a tip or word of wisdom for designing for reliability and maintainability, what would that be?
Tip makes it sound like it has to be 5 words. So let me expand that just a little bit. There's a lot of different points of view about a piece of equipment, right? There's the throughput, its primary function, its performance, its capabilities, its flexibility. All of those kinds of top level, this is what this equipment's supposed to do. Yet a lot of the cost of equipment and its maintenance and its care and feeding basically over time. And so it's getting the operators, the technicians, your maintenance team involved at that concept phase as you're speccing this thing out. It can really make a significant change to the overall return on investment of this new piece of equipment. And sometimes it's simple suggestions from people that have to deal with this equipment day in and day out that I see overlooked just a little bit too often. And I think that's the tip, is listen to the people from all the different points of view that have to deal with this equipment, not just the lowest price. That's really short-sighted.
Yeah, and I think if, normally I ask, what is the one thing you see done incorrectly when doing this stuff?
Yeah,
and I think
you don't listen to all those people.
Yeah, or go for the lowest price every time.
Right.
Price versus cost. We can have a whole conversation on price versus cost, and maybe that'll be our next episode.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, this is equipment you're making an investment in so that you and your factory can create products or create a value at the end of the day. And are you going to be just using whatever baling wire and chewing gum you got available, and what kind of product are you putting out? Or are you going to use good tools and have a consistent, clean process that to create your products? Both can get the job done at the end of the day, yet one will be a lot less problematic than the other.
Yep, absolutely. Now, do you have any resources on designing for reliability that you want to share with anyone?
Not really. I know there's a handful of articles on the site, on the Ascendo Reliability site. They tend to be aimed at the design process, not necessarily for these large industrial pieces of equipment, but just in general, just the everything from servers to cars, to aircraft, to all kinds of different things. So there's plenty of lessons learned there and best practices, but it's probably a good ebook I should put together, Design for Reliability. But there is a series, I should send it to you, James, there's a series of articles about design guidelines. That might be a good reference.
Absolutely. If you can send me that, I'll make sure to put it in the show notes.
Okay, cool.
All right, Fred, now, what else is going on with you? How's, speaking of reliability, coming?
Oh, I need to talk to you about that, James. Just rooted in reliability is kicking my butt on Google searches and SEO. And I noticed on the website, on the Ascendo, that one of the top searches was reliability podcasts. People are looking for podcasts. They're finally finding us. People are looking for us. That's a good thing. So I went and searched, I searched for reliability podcasts. And it was your show, Rooted in Reliability, was like the first three pages. So good job. I appreciate it. And it's you do a great show. And it's not just because I get to be on it every now and then, but it's because you do really cool interviews. You got some great guests and you got a lot of practical advice. Speaking of reliability, is doing well. We're getting close to, I think, 200,000 downloads or 300,000 downloads or something like that. It continues to grow month over month. It's getting nice comments and feedback. We had some really nice comments on even in listing specific episodes. That was his top three episodes and why. So that was pretty nice to see. And we're getting more and more feedback from people saying, hey, here's a topic we'd like you guys to talk about. Here's a problem I'm facing. How would you approach this? And so that's been pretty cool. We're enjoying that. And I know that you're getting some feedback on your show, and for listeners, it makes our day because we're talking into a microphone, and there's not an audience in front of us unless we hear from you. So reviews, comments, just a phone call or a quick email saying, "Hey, this show is great," or "What," or you know, "Here's a question you should have asked," or those kinds of things really make a difference in helping us to keep producing these shows. So.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you can reach out to us on Twitter at HP Reliability. You can email us RIRIR at HPReliability.com. Send us topics you want, guests you want. If you have burning questions you want to ask Fred, let us know and we'll make sure to cover those. Our goal here is to provide the value to the listeners. One of the big things I learned at the PMAC conference I was at last week is just how many people listen to it. I had numerous people come up to the booth there just to say thank you for the show, keep it going, you know, I learned so much from it, all these great things. But that's only because I was there at the show. If I wasn't there at the conference,
you went now,
I wouldn't have gotten any of that feedback. So, you know, don't hesitate to contact us any which way, shape or form. Let us know what you like, what you don't like, what you want to hear more of, and we'll make sure to get that on for everyone.
That's right. So has anybody stopped you on the street or at the grocery store saying, hey, I like your podcast?
I don't think I'm that popular yet.
Not yet. Yeah, that's our milestone. Then we know we made it, right?
Absolutely.
I guess we better be careful what we wish for.
Yes.
We'll have to buy sunglasses and, you know, go shopping. That would be a problem. Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen, though, not on our shows.
No, No one likes this stuff as much as us.
Well, I don't know. We gave them good comments, so it keeps us going. So that's all good.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Fred, I appreciate your time once again talking about how to design for reliability and some of these other areas that are opportunities for us to further provide value to the organizations that we all work for. So thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome, James. Talk to you again sometime.
Yep. Bye, Fred.
Bye-bye.
I would like to thank you for listening and remind you that you can always find out more on maintenance, reliability, and asset management at www.iridicio.com and by following our blog. The Rooted in Reliability podcast is a proud member of the reliability.fm network. I'd like to ask you to please rate and review this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. It ensures the podcast stays relevant and is easy to find by like-minded professionals. It is only with your ratings and reviews that the Rooted in Reliability podcast can continue to grow. I thank you for providing this small but critical support. We'll see you next week when we dive into another burning topic with Rooted in Reliability, your plant performance podcast.